My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come talk, and I'd like to thank the other speakers, and I'd like to thank Andy for just being a great host. We've had a great time. I got to meet his wife and his peach of a daughter, Ashley, who's wandering around somewhere, burbling right now. And there's a lot of people here this weekend I love and who I admire, good members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who I've had the pleasure of growing to know as I've gotten older, as I've grown up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're good members of AA, and as my friend, I heard my friend Dick say one time, and I hope it's something I'll never forget, he said he knew someone was a good member of AA, not because they told him that they were, but because they showed him that they were. And I've never forgotten that. I hope I never do. If you knew, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a great honor to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, to make coffee, to stand by the door and greet, or talk. Anybody here can give the talk. If you're new here, I want to tell you I have a great life today. And if you're new, I'm sure that throws the crap out of you. I'm sure you're just so delighted for me. And I know that because I know I was so thrilled for people having a good time when I came to AA. Just beside myself with joy for them. They'd sit and talk about the new house and the car and the family, and I'd sit in my seat and I'd say to myself, geez, you know, maybe you'll go home tonight and maybe your house will blow up. Maybe you'll blow up, you know? Then we'll see how spiritual you are next week. So if you're new here, I'd like to welcome you to AA. And if you're new, you are now privy to an unending, unsolicited reservoir of information and advice. They're going to get right up in your face and talk that long AA crap to you, you know. It's usually a guy with one tooth with a cavity in it, you know. Do I want what you've got? No! No, but thanks for spitting on me. I really appreciate it. And you see, the kind of bully I am is I'm a nice guy. I'm a sterling human being. I'm a hell of a nice guy, you know. That's how I've always tried to bully people into doing what I want them to do. So when I was new, I'd let them talk all that stuff to me. And I'd grin and shake my head and just pray that their face would burst into flame, you know. That they'd just go up in a column of smoke. I'm here. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't that bad enough? My life is over. And now I gotta listen to this guy, you know, with a belt buckle large enough to serve a whole fish on, you know. So glad I'm here. Beyond lame, you know, beyond lame. Some plateau of lameness I never even imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome. If you're a drug addict, I'd like to welcome you to AA. If you're a dope fiend, which is somehow worse than any of us, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And just suggest that you catch alcoholism. Catch alcoholism. You can have anything else you want. Just catch alcoholism. We'd love to give it to you. I love reasons for drinking. I collect them. You know, I have a new favorite reason to drink. It happened a couple of months ago. This guy I was working with for about 15 seconds. He lives with his wife. He's a male prostitute, and he has a gay lover. So he called me to tell me he drank. I said, why? I've got an inquiring mind. I want to know. He said, I caught my wife cheating on me. It doesn't get a lot better than that. You can't write that. They'll throw you out of the office if you write that. I was born in New York, city in the Bronx. Anybody here from the Bronx? Nobody here from the Witness Protection Program? Yeah, there she is. To a completely insane family. My family was completely out of their mind. My wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my aunt came and wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. Boy, I tell you, you know, the more I tell this story, the more I wish I was lying. These are my people. This is my genetic pool. And it was not a mistake. It was a look she was going after, you know? Now, I was not an alcoholic when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new here and you're not an alcoholic, please keep coming back, because you can... I caught alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. That's where I became alcoholic. And there were three initial reasons why I was not alcoholic. Number one, I'm Jewish, and Jews don't drink. Because it might dull the pain, you know? And you don't want that to happen. You don't want to squander any agony opportunity that presents itself. You want to be fully conscious for any misery that presents itself in your life. So I couldn't possibly be alcoholic because, number one, I was Jewish, and number two, I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. It's basically where I was. And so I just had some very, very complicated problems. And in addition to being Jewish and being in therapy for 18 years, I was not alcoholic. I was a dark, complicated artist. I was an artistic Jewish patient or something. I don't know. But I was not alcoholic. And when if you're new here and you don't have alcoholism, my sponsor is fond of saying that the infection takes place at the meetings. The infection enters through the ear and then infects the whole person, and they start infecting everybody around them. You know? I figure if they tell me I'm taking down seven people with me, then I'm buoying seven people when I get ahead. Turnaround's fair play, right? If I'm making seven people sick, I at least have a shot at helping seven people have some light in their life. I like that. This family, I felt a little different growing up in this family. I had an uncle who was one of the top 10 welterweights during the 1930s. He was a very successful boxer. His name was Izzy Redman, and he had a fight in Atlanta, Georgia. He was very concerned about anti-Semitism and had his name changed to Izzy Goldberg so no one would know he was Jewish. He thought they'd think he was German. It was 1939. The Germans were really pulling in fans all over the place. And these were my people. My dad thought he was a real loser, and I absolutely agreed with him. I thought he was a sap and a sucker. My dad never made more than $10,000 a year. My brother and I never missed a meal and never went to school with ripped clothing. My last year drinking, I made $80,000. My children did go to school with ripped clothing, and they did miss meals on a regular basis. How does such a thing happen? You put those two pictures down of these two men, my father and I. How could a human being look at these two pictures and come away with the impression that my father was a loser? And yet I did, over and over and over again. And if you're new, the reason why, I can tell you exactly the reason why. Because a certain kind of thinking had become established in me that emplaced me beyond human help. Because I had so drastically rearranged my life and my point of view of life to accommodate the tapeworm of alcoholism that I was able to perceive things and see things in a light that made absolutely no sense to the non-alcoholic eye. The alcoholic mind is like an incredible clock that takes the most precise, perfect time in the universe for 1 minute and then skips a century. You know? When it works, it is beautiful. And when it doesn't, it leaves gaps large enough to move an entire culture through. I have a friend named Larry in the program. It's one of the most beautiful examples of alcoholic thinking I've ever heard. When he first read our book, and he read the first page of chapter 4, and he read the sentence that says, to paraphrase basically, to face a spiritual life or an alcoholic death is not an easy decision to make. And when he first read that, he said to himself, well, how bad an alcoholic death are we talking about here? Normal people don't do that. And things started going poorly for me pretty much out of the gate. As a young man in the Bronx, I was growing up and trying to achieve achieve in my peer group. The first peer group I picked was a bunch of young guys who were stealing cars and smashing them into each other, having sort of ersatz demo derbies all over the neighborhood. This is a bunch of young rocket scientists that I was trying to get in with these guys, and I was being brought into this gang by a guy named George. There's a circle of guys around me, and it was a big moment for me, you know. And I said, look, all we do is Chevy Biscaynes and Fairlanes, because they got the ignitions on the column. This is a few years ago. And you punch out the fly window, you get in, and if it's on, with these cars, if it's on lock, just shine the car, find another car. If it's on off, take your house key, put it in the car, turn around and drive off. That's what you could do with those cars. And I looked around the circle, I said, what if it's on? He said, oh, then someone's in the car, you moron. And I failed Gang 101. And I went right for these other guys, the other guys in the neighborhood that I was fascinated with. They were wearing bell-bottom jeans. 1966, 1967. And at that time, the sobriety police are here. If you got on a New York City bus wearing bell-bottoms, people got up and moved away from you on the bus. And that looked awful good to me. People moving away from you. That was a lofty goal for me. And and what I did at that point is I became engaged in an activity which, very much like psychotherapy, I'm not putting therapy down. Therapy is great stuff. It says on page 133 of our book, if you need a doctor, go get one. It does say in the description of the fifth step, no wonder those in the medical profession have such a low opinion of our chances for recovery because we've so seldom told these people the truth. My colossal blunder is I was trying to treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy, which is like showing up at a gunfight with a knife, and I didn't know it. I was trying to treat a threefold illness with psychology, which is one fold. I was two folds short. I didn't even know. I was doing good work in therapy, and I was dying from alcoholism. I was going to be like a very well analyzed corpse, you know, by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, but no Oedipal conflict, but dead, and I already had the therapy going, which was helping me dodge this alcoholic dilemma I was in. And then once I gravitated to these other people, I started, I always drank, but then what I would do is I would drink till I didn't want to be a drunk. I would smoke pot to overcome my alcohol problem. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers here today. You remember WOW, right? WOW. WOW. Right after WOW usually came, what? What? WOW, what, WOW, what, WOW, what? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum, you know? It's like, there is a lot of activity, but no movement. But there's a lot of stuff happening there. They're busy folk. I overcame my marijuana problem with pills. I triumphed over pills with cocaine. Cocaine's a fabulous drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I kicked that gall-darn cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, exciting, artistic drug. And you cross the line and become a vomiting pig. It's just a little hop, skip, and a jump. And I conquered that gall-darn heroin with alcohol. And I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk. And I swapped addictions and went to psychotherapy and managed not to catch alcoholism, even begin to catch it, until I was almost dead from it. My wife and children were almost dead from it at the age of 33 years old. And I was in a cycle where I was shooting heroin, and my father had a massive stroke. I was about 20 years old, 21 at that time, and I was taken to the hospital. I couldn't be there for my dad. And I collapsed as a man, as a son, as a brother. I failed. My father was lost to me. I couldn't even think about him. I couldn't even look at pictures of him. I couldn't hear the sound of a heart machine without it feeling like it was a personal indictment of my failure as a son and a brother. I couldn't look at pictures of him. And there was just this horrible black hole anytime I thought of my dad. Because the curtain was down. I could not be there for him. And I knew what the problem was, and I swore that I would fix that problem. And I decided that there and then, that morning, I would never, ever put a needle in my arm again. Because that was the problem. And I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, smoked pot till I didn't want to be a pothead, and continued my alcoholic journey of it's a funny thing. If you have, if you're new here and you're dreaming about drinking, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Normal people don't dream about drinking.
My mother has never dreamt about walking into a palace made of cocaine. My cousin Roz has never dreamt about paddling down a river of beer. They don't have these. I defy you to produce one normal human being who has these dreams. I do. If you're new here, that doesn't mean you're going to drink if you're having them. Let the dream help you take step one on a little deeper level. So maybe you can surrender a little bit more and commit a little more and surrender a little more and commit a little more and watch your sobriety grow. The road doesn't get narrower here. It gets bigger and bigger. Our book just talks about the broad highway, the great reality, the great idea. It talks about life getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And what I'm telling you now is about how my life got smaller and smaller and smaller. Because if you have this strange physical reaction to alcohol that makes it impossible for you to moderate once you begin, and it's mixed with that fascinating thinking that we've been talking about this morning, you know, the kind that can get you to drink once you catch your wife cheating on you. And these two things get mixed together. It forms this soul sickness, this cancer of the soul. And once you're in the clutches of that, and, you know, again, it says in our book, once that thinking becomes established, you probably place yourself beyond human help. Always good news for the new man. It seems the only thing that can help is the bromide that's available in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have a monopoly on it. People get sober a lot of different ways. But by the time I'm describing to you, by the time my dad passed away and I swore off heroin for the rest of my life, that was my problem, and I began my descent, my accelerated descent, I had crossed that line. And I thought I was a free man, and the fact is I did anything alcoholism told me to do. I did it exactly whenever it told me to do it, and I did it for exactly how long it told me to do it for. It says in our book, we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. Driven is not nudged or influenced. Driven implies under the lash of, in slavery to. And it owned me and it ate my breakfast every morning and I didn't even know it. So if you're new here and you're worried about being an AA robot, let AA robot be a lofty goal. If you're scared of getting brainwashed, it might need a good scrubbing. You know? By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had acted in a Broadway play. I had directed a television show and a movie. I had had a best-selling book, a book on the bestseller list. I had my own theater in New York. I had done all of these things a ton. I never got to do any of them more than once, because when I'd leave, they'd move the business so I couldn't find it again. And and once I took the alcoholic test, I found out why. If you're new here, we have a test. Other diseases, they have blood tests and x-rays. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have an inventory. That's the alcoholic test. It's a pass-pass situation. All you have to do is do it, you pass. And if you do the inventory, you will actually see a picture of your alcoholism. If you do the whole thing. Now, sometimes guys I sponsor, they'll say, geez, you know, this feels so bad. Can I just come over and read you what I have? And I encourage them not to. The book doesn't say write a little, read a little, write a little, read a little. It says, if you've been thorough, you've written a lot. It says, you do a searching, fearless inventory. And if you can, and I think these guys knew that if you could sit down and read the whole mess, admit the whole mess, I'm resentful at them, I'm resentful at me for resenting them, I'm resentful at them for watching me resent them, and I've had sex with all of them, all right? Newcomers, what does this have to do with alcoholism? It is alcoholism! It's what will keep you in that loop of spree and remorse and keep your finger blaming other people until the day you die. And I had no power to get out of the cycle of spree and remorse. Silkworth talks about our problems piling up at a seemingly unsolvable rate. We don't have any tools to elicit any power to get us out of that cycle, and we're crushed under the weight of them. And you can see it over and over again with people who come into AA and aren't willing around to stand and take the whooping. So, when I did my inventory and I took the picture of my alcoholism, I saw that early on, people were doing things behind my back. A little later on, they started talking behind my back. And in the last few horrible years, they were thinking behind my back. which is awful, you know, because it's so hard to catch them. It really is. It really is. But you know as well as I, you can. you know? Just got to stay focused. And you'll get them. It was shortly after my dad died, and I was acting in a Broadway play, and there was a new usherette with long brown hair, and I took one look at this woman. I went back into the dressing room of this theater, and I stood on a chair, and I said, I announced to all the guys in that dressing room, I said, if anybody talks to the new usherette with long brown hair, I'll break all the small bones in your hands and feet. And every time a guy walked near Nancy, he'd go, trying to dash away, and she couldn't figure out quite what was going on, and I just absolutely fell in love with this woman, and she with me, and we had great dreams and great plans, and we had alcoholism, and we didn't know. We were just a couple of dogs trying to run on linoleum. We were going nowhere fast, but we had great intentions and great dreams, and we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun, and I remember when we first started, right before we got married, we were in bed together, and Nancy looked at me. I woke up, and she was looking at me. And I said, what? And she looked at me in the eyes and said, you're trouble, aren't you? And I said, yeah. We celebrated 20 years of marriage last week, so she stuck around for the trouble. I'll never forget the day my wife had been in Al-Anon a couple of years, and we were talking about the disease of alcoholism, and she described something to me that I will never forget. And now I'm talking about when we got married, because I now know, after she explained to me what her disease is all about, and I continue to learn more about it because she shares her disease with me, she described with me, knowing that she had pushed every button on me and gotten me completely nuts. Then she described to me the feeling of getting right up in my face like this, to just put the cherry on top, you know? And she described the feeling that I know very well. It's the feeling that I would go, that I had when I had $4 in my pocket and I was headed down to the convenience store for some beer. It's the same feeling I got when I met with my connection. It was a breathless relief that I was going to be immersed in the thing, the only thing that stopped me thinking about Scott Redmond, or I thought would stop me thinking about Scott Redmond. And when we started going out there, my wife started getting very, very sick from prolonged exposure to me. And we became very, very sick together. We became so sick that at one point a guy lent us his car and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, You sold my car. I lent you my. That's like house sitting for someone, and they come back, and you're an escrow, you know. And we were proud of it. It was the end of the month. We didn't have the rent. I looked at my wife's eyes. I said, "Sweetheart, I am so sick of acting like an immature punk kid. Let's not borrow money. Let's stand on our own 2 feet. Let's sell the car." And she looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, "Let's do it." I came home one day and we had these 32-ounce iced tea tumblers, and I popped the cork on a bottle of wine and emptied the entire bottle of wine in this cup, and I look up and I'm getting the pre-Al-Anon rat face, you know. I said, "What?" She said, "What are you doing?" And completely seriously, I said, "I'm having a glass of wine." Can a man have a glass of wine in his own home? Anytime that I want to tell you the story about my last, it was actually my last overdose, but when my wife tells the story, I always get the willies a little bit, because she came home and I had an idea to cook something, but I died in the middle of the idea. And she came home, there was a pan of eggs on my chest and the oven was on, and I was, you know, purple, you know, on the floor. There's an empty vial of pills next to me, and she tapped me with her foot and said, "How are you?" And I said, I'm really tired. So she goes and calls the doctor and describes the situation to him. The doctor said, "Why are you calling me? Why aren't you calling the paramedics? There's a blue Jew on the floor of the kitchen." I'm like, "What? Why in God's name would you be calling me?" So when Nancy tells her, she says, she hung up the phone and thought about it. And then called another doctor for a second opinion. Which she did. Oh, man. When our older son was born, we were surrounded by friends and family. There was a ton of phone calls and a bunch of lots of flowers at the hospital. Micah was really welcomed into this world. A lot of people around, you know. A joyous moment. It's such a great way to be in a hospital when a kid gets born. It's really the only time I like to be in a hospital, you know. And I can't get enough of it. I get to do that a lot now, and I love it. And when my oldest son was born, he was really welcomed into the world. And 2 years and 9 months later, when Jesse was born, our younger son, there was nobody at the hospital. There were no flowers, no phone calls. We were completely isolated by the disease of alcoholism in 2 years and 9 months. And Jesse got sick. He had to go up to neonatal intensive care. And I was home with Micah, and this doctor called me that night. And a doctor I'd never met, a woman. And she said, "Mr. Redmond, your wife and your son really need you down here." I said, "I understand that. But the fact is that I can't find anybody to watch my 2-year-old kids so I can come down and be with Nancy and Jesse." Because they were all alone. And I mean, Nancy was having a real tough time, and this doctor had saw it. And I said, I can't find anybody to watch my kids. And this doctor, who I had never met before, said to me that morning, "I'll tell you what, why don't I give you my address, and you can bring your son over to my house, and my husband will watch him for you." What an extraordinary thing for anybody to do, who I don't know, and especially a doctor. And I said, no. There was no way that I could accept that kindness. There was no way that I could accept that gesture of generosity. I was too sick. And it's not like I was doing my son a favor. Now he's locked in the house with this completely insane dad who's racked with guilt and self-loathing. I would have done better to take him to the hospital and leave him in the waiting room of the coloring book. At least he could have gotten away from me for a little while. That's where we wound up. That's how thick. And people were not around, not because they didn't love us. It hurt too much to be around us. The ice around our heart had become so thick. We had rearranged our lives so thoroughly to accommodate alcoholism. Things became okay to do that weren't okay to do. You guys told me I wasn't bad getting good. I was sick getting well when I came in. And that's true. But the fact is I felt bad. And I'll tell you why. I acted bad all the time. And it wasn't until I started acting good that I started feeling good. And I couldn't, because no matter what I said, I was going to take the walk to the drink no matter what. And if you were my kid and you got in between me and the drink, didn't matter what I said over here. Doesn't matter what I say, because by the time I get over here, the bike money might have to go to alcohol. My kids never had the right stuff. They never had the right lunchbox, the right jeans. I'm not talking about a lot of dough. I'm talking about a loose leaf folder. I'm talking about a couple of bucks. And the days, the few days where they had the right stuff, and I didn't find this out until I got sober and stayed sober for a while and was able to really take in some information that if I had had when I was new, my brain would have exploded. Because the truth is, the days that I gave myself credit for doing the right thing, it was done in such a way that it was still off. I would give them a folder like I was giving them some kind of Oscar. That the stuff was given to them in such an inappropriate, crazy way, it still felt marked and dirtied and still felt them cut out from the pack. Stuff was happening in other homes in a kind of reasonably relaxed way. And in ours, something like a pair of sneakers were being presented like we had found the treasure of Sierra Madre. And it took me a while in sobriety, being sober and doing the work in Alcoholics Anonymous and seeing the sickness in the families of new people, for me to admit that that had happened in my home. You know, we had a big party. We have big parties in my house. We have a great time. And this is at the house where we couldn't get anybody to watch our 2-year-old son. And I always know the newcomers' kids always bring guns. Lots of guns. Big guns. Dark guns. Berettas. These kids are strapped. I mean, and the kids who have been sober for a while, they don't bring guns to our house, you know. But any time I see a gun in our backyard, I know a newcomer's in there. When Micah was 5, he came up to me and he said, "Dad, is there anything such as God?" And I looked into the eyes of my perfect, beautiful 5-year-old baby boy, and I said, "No, son, there isn't." And I thought I was doing him a favor. I thought I was giving him the real deal. I thought I was saving him some time and trouble so he wouldn't have to be played like a sap or a sucker, like one of the saps or suckers out there. I really thought I was doing a valiant and brave thing. Not only did I lie to the kid, not only did I give him bad information, but as opposed to giving him the brave way out, I actually presented him with the coward's way out. And if you're new here, I want to urge you to read the fourth chapter of our book. It's an incredible document. What it puts forward is the notion that you already have the equipment necessary to get, become part of, and stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. That you already have faith. You have been presenting your faith to something that doesn't respond in a good way. You have been focusing your faith on something that's killing you. We're going to give you some spiritual tools that will move your faith to something that will save your life. But that you already have what is necessary. If you believe in a higher power or even believe that it's possible that one exists, we emphatically assure you you're on your way. It's a huge hoop. A huge hoop to jump through. And it also puts forward the notion that to stand in the presence of all this immutable law, to stand in the presence of all of this joy, to stand in the presence of this universe and say that there is no higher power is mushy, weak, and cowardly thinking. I hated that. and that's what I gave my son that morning. Weak, cowardly, and mushy thinking. And on April 20th, 1985, I crossed a line I swore I would never cross again, because I swore I would never put a needle in my arm again, and as long as I didn't, it made everything else okay. As long as I didn't put that needle in my arm, all this other behavior was acceptable, because I wasn't an alcoholic. I was a ex-dope fiend. And on April 20th, 1985, I crossed a line that I swore I would never cross. I put a needle in my arm, and my life and my world came crashing down around me. Why, I don't know. Why it came crashing around me that day, I don't know. I called my therapist that morning. I told him what I had done, and he said to me that morning on that phone, he said to me, "There's absolutely nothing that can be done for you." I said, "What?" He said, "I can't help you. The only thing I can suggest is you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or we have you institutionalized." Now, this was a new therapist, a Jungian therapist. I'd never had a Jungian before, and that was no small thing for me, because once I was to come into AA and read our book, I was to find out that Carl Jung played a considerable role in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was to find out that he told the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson, Carl Jung himself, told that guy the exact same thing that therapist told me. That there was nothing that could be done for me. That modern psychology was not going to be able to help me out of this alcoholic dilemma. Now, why I went to that AA meeting and did not go to the institution, that I can't tell you why. Most other mornings, I would have gone right to the home for the silly. I would have been right there. Take me with the nervous people. That's where I want to be, you know? Be with my people, you know, my colorful, adventurous people. Why I went to that AA meeting, I don't know. But I woke up at 7 o'clock in the morning and I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, go to a 7 a.m. meeting, put on all my best clothes to report to Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked into that room and I sat down and I looked around and I said, Alcoholics Anonymous. How did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? How lame is this? I just couldn't believe it. Beyond synagogue, beyond church, I could not believe I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hated everything about it. Everybody was a miracle. Miracle, miracle. The coffee's a miracle. The furniture's a miracle. Miracle. I'm telling you, if they had come out with adult diapers, it would have kept me out there 2 more years. I would have just gone right back out. I'm glad that Depends has only come out recently, because I'm sure you could have a different speaker here this morning. And I do not know why I came back. The only thing I can imagine reason that I came back is that I was out of plans. And if you're new here, I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you're new and you have a plan, it's probably a beaut. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. My favorite newcomer plan in the last years has been the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. Right? It's out there. It's out there. It's going to wind up on the soft literature rack eventually. So this sucker is being used as we speak. And I kept coming back to AA meetings, and I hated it. And I'd sit there with that awful smile. I was wet everywhere on my body except where I needed it, in my mouth, you know, sweating that horrible green sweat. And I stuck around here 6 months and enjoyed the gift of step nun. You know the gift of step nun? Nothing! I thought I had taken the first three steps. Well, the third step says it'll have a little permanent effect unless it's followed by a fourth step. I hadn't done that. So the third step's really not going to be in part of my life. It's going to kind of come and go if I haven't. That's what, not my opinion, it's what the book says. So I guess I worked the first two steps. I admitted I was an alcoholic, which is a fatal illness. My life is unmanageable. And I come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore my sanity. Could, not would, not should, but that it was possible. So I admitted I was dying and my life sucked and I was out of my mind. How come I don't feel any better? Why should I have felt any better after a period of time? I mean, sure, I'm going to get some juice when I take those first three steps, but for me, once I did that inventory and really saw what I was turning over to God, because otherwise I'm saying, Father, I'm yours, and he says, oh, yeah, I knew that. I'm God, but thanks. It's a very nice gesture. It's very kind of you. When I said, Father, take this, take these resentments, these defects, these fears, this sexual misconduct, mold me, shape me, let me come up with an ideal, let me help me walk toward it. And then I started taking the actions that was going to help me fulfill those goals as instructed by my sponsor. Man, unbelievable stuff started happening for me. Started happening in my life. But I was 6 months sober. I had worked no steps. I was getting the gift of working no steps. I was out of my mind and I knew I was going to drink. I had seen the AA drill hundreds and hundreds of times in just the scant 6 months I had been here. Hundreds of times. I saw people come in, do the work and change. People come in, didn't do the work, didn't change, got sick, got sicker, got to the podium, shared their gift with us, and then shared their ass right out of the door. And I'd seen hundreds of times, so I knew I was going to drink. And my wife had reached out to the Al-Anon family groups and had begun her miracle. And my sons had stopped being quite so scared all the time. By the time I got to AA, Micah was six. He was making involuntary clicking noises with his throat that he couldn't stop making. He couldn't stop grinding his teeth. He tested in excess of 168 IQ and could barely read or write because he was so distracted from being scared all the time. That's what happens when you live in a psychological theme park. And what ride will we be taking today? And when you get in between me and the drink and you're my child, you have to either become paper mache, something less than human, or you have to disappear. Because it doesn't matter what I say over here, it only matters what happens over here. And if you get in between me and the drink, I either got to walk around you or I got to walk through you. And how much disappearing can a baby bear before the baby believes what it's being told, which is that it doesn't exist? And that's what happened to my sons. They disappeared. And then the kids become pointlessly aggressive to prove that they're in a universe they've been counted out of, or they just throw in the towel. And they go into the half-lit corner of the house, and they stay there. And they just hope nobody sees them that day. And that's what happened to my sons, and it happened to them different ways on different days. You know, just like our book says, sometimes we're nice and sometimes we're violent, but it's all about getting our way when our thinking is not right. And that was the same for my sons. They had, it was different ways on different days, but it was all the same illness. And I knew I was going to drink. I had seen the AA drill enough to know that I was going to drink if I continued the course that I was on. So I asked the guy to sponsor me. And for me, I think in many ways it was because of the demonstration that I saw in my wife's life and in my son's life. Because right before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I reached across our dinner table to get something. My arm came near my older son, and he went like this. And it wasn't voluntary. It was a reflex reaction. And my heart fell out of my head. Because that's some place I never even imagined that I would wind up being. And so I asked the guy to sponsor me. And I did something I had rarely done in my life. I went to a good guy for something he had. I was used to going to bad guys for stuff they didn't have. I was used to going to drowning people and asking for swimming lessons, you know. And when all they'd say is glub, 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 I'd get pissed off. And then I'd wait a while and go back and ask them again. I went to a good guy for something he had. And this guy, You know, I know what we're saying when we say, I don't know anything. I understand that. And I understand what people are saying when they say that. But I didn't hear this guy say that. He knew a lot. He had a lot of sober experience. He was able to talk about the steps and about 12-step work, about bringing light into other people's lives. Not bragging about it. He just talked about the work he was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. In really specific, concrete terms. There was no black robe and a chicken foot. He was talking about he was doing A and he was getting B. But without C, there's nothing. Without C, there's just A and B. That's the relationship I had with my therapist and myself and my wife. Once the triangle took place, once there was a higher power involved, that's a whole other deal. And this guy took me on and he invited me to his apartment and he spent hours and hours with me one day for fun and for free. And I couldn't figure out why. I didn't know what he wanted. He read chapter 5 to me and he took me through the first 3 steps. And we got on our knees and prayed together. We finished chapter 5 and he went back and he gave me instructions on how to do a 4th step in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took 3 months and I did that inventory. I came back to him at 9 months of sobriety and I read my inventory to him. And I read the whole thing. And I was so crushed under the weight of it. It deflated me at least at enough depth. And I know this now, I didn't know it then, that I would be able to... I was convinced enough that the Scott Redmond program was not panning out that I was able to stick around Alcoholics Anonymous one more day. And I did step 6 and 7 for the first time. Then it came time to do my 8-step list. I try to share this anytime I talk. It's the best reading of the 8-step I've ever heard in my life. And I heard it at my old home group, and it was done by a guy named Nino. He was a guy from New York with a heavy New York accent. I'd never seen this guy before this night, and I've never seen him since, and I hope I never forget him. He was reading chapter 5 for the first time. He was there with a hospital group. He had a hospital bracelet on. He had never read chapter 5 before. And he was reading it in front of this men's group that night. And he got up to step 8 and he read, made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, have you seen it? You know what's in here, man! It was so beautiful. It was so... It's the purest reading of the step I've ever heard. Because, come on, man. That was it's the only thing I saw in the steps when I first read the steps. No, not those people, not that money. I would not have taken that much money if I knew I had to pay it back. No way! No way would I have taken that much! Right? So if you're new, don't worry. It's 8 steps from where you are anyway. It's not 8 you have to worry about. It's 9. So made up my 8-step list. I had to put my dad, my wife, and my kids down there, and I had to absolutely not put me on there. And the reason why I share that today is not to criticize anybody who puts themselves on their 8-step list. But I felt like I needed to not be on it, and I heard a lot of people at meetings talking about putting themselves on it, so I had to know that. Don't take my program as an indictment of yours. It was such a... Because I heard it in meetings and I got confused about it. And I'm here to talk... I've been asked to talk about how I'm living joyously with the 12 steps, so what the hell, call me a nut, I'll go ahead and talk about it. And a key for me was to not put myself on my 8-step list. That was just a real important thing to me. Now, because I had been making amends to Scott Redmond, hopefully at your expense, for 33 years. I didn't know what I was going to do about my dad. You know, I said to my sponsor, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. And he didn't say go to the grave. He didn't say anything. He said, well, neither do I. You know when they say those things to you, you go, you know, the first thing you think is, you call yourself a sponsor? or you're not earning your money? You know, that's it. We're going to have to review your job performance. That's what I say when people fire their sponsor. Fire? What do you think you are? What are you talking about? Fire. Open my big book. There's a pink slip in it this morning, you know? What the hell are you talking about? Man. You know when a guy calls you to tell you you're not your sponsor, you put the phone, you hand over the phone, going, oh, thank you! Thank you! Well, you gotta do what you gotta do, you know? I'll try to move on without you. Oh, man. And I didn't know what I was going to do to make it up to Nancy and the boys. You know, let's see. I'll sit down with Nancy and I'll say, gee, honey, I'm so sorry about this 8-year journey to Hades. Forgive me? sure. That's a goodie. So what I had to do was I had to start doing a lot of lame crap. I couldn't sit down with my sons and say, gee, boy, I'm so sorry you've had no life. I had to start doing a lot of lame crap. I had to start, like, coaching flag football and going to Little League games. I had to stop telling my kids to go do their homework and start saying, do you need any help with your homework? Not that I could help them. I don't understand most of what they're learning, you know? But let me tell you, I heard at an AA meeting early on, I heard a guy share, said, I don't have any money. So what I do is, I can't pay child support, so what I do is I go and I mow my ex-wife's lawn so that I can feel okay when I go to visit my kids. That's incredible. He didn't have the cash to give her, so he did all this other stuff to pay her so he could walk in there proud of who he was and show up for his kids and not get a bunch of dirty looks, which he just would have deserved. You know? And so what I mean is I couldn't help with their homework, but I could take some alcohol money and I could hire a tutor. I could get them learning materials. I can give them a home that's not a battle zone to work in. I can buy them a computer. I'm telling you, if you're new here, God is saving you some serious money. You know, and if you manage to get pissed off about 10 or 20 of it, sit down with a computer and figure out how much he's saved you since you've been sober. Even if you've been sober 2 days. You're in the black, babe. You're doing great. And I started, you know, the first Little League game I showed up at, my wife comes to the, I go to the Little League game, Nancy shows up at the game, takes one look over at there's the first base stands, takes one look and just falls on the floor laughing. Because there's all the people, they're in the first base stands, and there I am, alone in the sun, pissed off. Right? I'm here, I'm doing my job, I'm here, I'm making amends, I'm here, I'm here! Going up 3-4 hatch sizes, right? Nuts! The kids were thrilled to see me, you know? Mr. Ridman's gonna blow up, I'm telling you, man, look at him! Psychotic! It took me a couple of years for the voices to diminish in volume and number to go and sit with the people in the first base stands, just to be with the people in the first base stands. A couple of months ago, my son had a music recital, and I go into the auditorium, and I just sat down in the auditorium, and I said, I'm just in the auditorium with the people. And I started to cry. And then people move away from me. You know, the guy sitting in the auditorium going, the kids are playing the Mexican hat dance, and I'm crying. You know, it makes a lot of... Isn't that great hearing an entire orchestra play the Mexican hat dance? You only get that in junior high school. It's really... And I'm blubbering, you know. And I started doing a lot of lame crap. You know, if the day I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, you looked at me in the eye and said, someday, if you're lucky enough, you'll be able to go to a Little League game. Wonder if I can get off more than one round before I go down, you know? And the payoff for me is a couple of years ago, my son Jesse was playing baseball and he received one of the greatest compliments a human being can receive in this world, on a field or off a field. He was intentionally walked. Doesn't get a lot better than that, folks. Let's face it, for anybody. That means they're scared of you and they want to get to the weenie behind you. Right? How's that for a lifestyle, you know? And he didn't want to be a geek and jump up and down and scream and yell. You know, he just put his bat down. Trotted up the first baseline, and on the way up the first baseline, he turned to me, because now I'm at my sobriety station, I'm in the first base stands, you know? And he just turned to me and shot me that much stuff. Just that much. Not too much, it's the old man, you don't want to be lame, you know? Just give him a little bit. Just a little bit. And I could have missed the whole thing. I'm not telling you Jesse got intentionally walked because I'm sober. I'm telling you I was at my sobriety station because I'm sober. Because that's the kind of sobriety I was given in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what the heroes do. They sit in the first baseline. And at that concert I told you about, Jesse made sure he knew where I was sitting so that after his percussion solo, he could stand up and just shoot me a little bit of stuff because I was in my sobriety station. And
In my first year of sobriety, I was very, very fortunate. Around the end of my first year, I started sponsoring men and very young in sobriety. And don't give away anything you don't have, but what you have, give it all away. That was what I was told. And one of the first guys I started sponsoring was a guy named Roland, and he used to call me every night, leave a message on my machine. And it said, Scott, it's Rolly, I'm sober, I love you, and good night, every night. And years after this, I told you the condition Micah was in when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, how scared he was all the time. Years after this, Micah told me that he could not fall asleep until he heard Roland's voice on the phone. And once he heard Roland's voice on the phone, he knew nothing had changed in the house and he could go to sleep. And what I think was happening was, I think he was staying awake until he passed out because he was so scared all the time. And just, now this is the kid I told him there was no God. I try to rip God out of his life. And you guys just, you came through the answering machine. You put him to bed every night. You came in the back door. My friend Kathy gives a great Al-Anon talk. She always says that once one person in her family got sober, she knew that they were coming for her. She just knew. It was just, they were coming for her. And that's, I didn't know that, but you came for us. And you came over the answering machine and you came for us and you got my boys. You know, and you pried their mouth open and you breathed life into them for the first time. In my first couple of years of sobriety, I was making the boys lunch. And again, I just to remind you how scared Micah was, how terrified this kid was. I was a couple of years sober. I was making the boys lunch. And I said to Micah, what do you want on your hot dog? And he said, I want mustard, onions, and lettuce. I said, lettuce? He said, okay, no lettuce. And he walked away, and he came back about 45 minutes later and looked at me directly in the eyes. And I'm not altering one syllable. He said to me, I will never again allow your opinion of what I want affect what I ask for. So I asked him to sponsor me at that point. What the hell is that? What is that? What planet is that from? I was sober a while, and I said to Jesse, I said, I've got a brainstorm. And he put his hand on my shoulder and looked at me in the eyes, and he said, oh, Dad, it's probably just a drizzle. And the end of my first year of sobriety, I had a ghostwriting job at 20th Century Fox. I was a ghost pretty much. That was a good job for me. And at the end of the first year, I was becoming sort of a spiritual Goliath. You know, I had about a year by that time. And I was being considered to direct a situation comedy. And I didn't get the job, and I almost drank. And I was humiliated. And I went to my sponsor. I told him what had happened. And he said to me, I guess the show business god has failed you utterly. I said, what? He said, well, you had to, if you're going to drink because you don't get the show business job, I guess you have the show business God, because if you don't get the job and God disappears and you're going to drink, that's the show business God. And, you know, the fact is when I came into AA, I heard God getting people jobs, getting people into relationships. I heard God getting people parking spaces, you know. I said, not the parking space God, not the parking space God. What do you do if you don't get a space, you know? And if you have a parking space, God, and he gives you space, pass it on. Bad idea, bad idea. So I wrote the resentment against myself for almost drinking and the company for not giving me that job. And when I did step 6 and 7, and humbly asked them to remove those difficulties. Now, humbly isn't, take them if you can, big guy. Humbly isn't, take them, you rotten son of a bitch. Humbly is, Father, can you please do this for me? I can't bear this anymore. I can't. Can you please? I know you can keep Saturn on its axis, but you can't handle my stuff, right? Can you please help me out here? That for me is humbly. And I said, my prayer that morning, I said 6 and 7. And I said, you take show business. Show business is yours. Have it. I'm willing to do anything. I will do anything for a living. Just keep me sober. And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck.
And I looked up to God and I said, I didn't mean this. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding. I did not mean this. Now, in Los Angeles, when they make a TV show or a movie, they have a caterer that follows you around, them around and makes food for them, and it's a great gig. You can make a lot of dough. It's Teamster dough. It's like breaking a racketeering law, for God's sake. You're on a vehicle on a movie set. You make really good money. But I'm Scott Redman. So the first movie I cater, the executive producer and star of the movie is a guy I've worked with in the business. And that first morning, he sticks his head out of the kitchen truck and he says, can I have a burrito? Scott? And I turn around and I said, what's happening there? He said, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. And I went home and called my sponsor and said, oh, we're getting the gift now. Oh, are we getting the gift of sobriety now? It's America. America, America. So it sounds like you've got a resentment. So I sat down and I wrote, I'm resentful of Scott Redman for working on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. Now, resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual illness, the great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, drag your ass out, and kill you dead. But don't be alarmed. No big deal. No biggie. Work a step a year. You don't hear that pearl very much anymore. I'm going to die. What am I going to ask God to remove? The guy, the burrito, the truck? What am I asking God to remove? What is it in me? What poison in me? It's killing me that if God, blue sky, if God's got a magic wand, comes down and touches me on the, what is it in me if it disappeared like that would be this resentment, this fatal resentment would be gone. I have false pride. I'm grandiose. How dare a man of my caliber work on a kitchen truck, make money, and bring it home? I'm impatient. Things aren't moving along. Selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking, you know, they're the same, but they're a little different. And I like to get as specific as I can when I talk to God. Selfish is kind of wanting it all for me. Self-seeking is trying to figure out what's in it for me. And self-centered is figuring it's all about me, kind of. So this was offering. Shame. This is the list I had to write down. Admit to another man and then discuss with God and ask him what I had to do. And it says in the last sentence, chapter 4, when we drew close to him, he revealed himself to us. And I ask, you see, the opposite of shame is pride. Not pridefulness, but pride. And I had to learn how to be proud of being a good cook. But you see, what you have to do in order to do that is you have to become a good cook. And good cooks show up on time. And good cooks listen to complaints and fix complaints. And don't spit in your chili when you're not looking. Not that I have ever even considered doing something like that. And I wound up serving people who had been my assistant directors and my stage managers. I wound up serving people who I had directed in shows. And when I began this process, I thought I had fallen from a height. And I did not know, because I had not worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and had not yet received the top rank in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is Child of God. Once you achieve the top rank in Alcoholics Anonymous, you have no place to fall. There's no place to fall from. And I got to be of some help as I became a good cook. As I showed up every day and gave them a dime for their nickel, I became able to help people who felt they had fallen from a height. I have a friend named Paul who came in and he used to say this prayer. He told me that years ago. He said to God, Father, I'm willing to do anything, just keep me sober, but please don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott. I was so glad to have helped Paul out. And I had been cooking for a couple of years and became good at it. And became free. And I was approached by a public relations firm in New York to do some comedy writing for them. And
And the old brain fever came back. Because if I had this comedy writing job, I think I could have been more helpful to more alcoholics.
And I crashed and burnt. You know, I got the brain fever back. You know when you get, when that vein's pumping like a garden hose on your forehead. You know that. And I had to write about it and surrender before I even heard about the job. I had to do this videotape for him and all this stuff. And I wrote the 10-step, called my sponsor, and read it. And a couple of weeks later, I got a call from Ketchum, told me I did not have the job. And I was okay with it. I had already gotten God involved. I hung up the phone, and the phone rang again, and it was my catering company asking me if I could go cater a commercial up in Lake Arrowhead, in the hills above L.A. I said, sure. I got in there, got up in the kitchen truck, got up to the commercial, grabbed the call sheet, which gives you all the info about the commercial, and who was the commercial for? It was for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. I look down at the end of the truck, and there's a guy with a videotape camera. I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm videotaping the making of the commercial. He's taping my humiliation. So they go to New York, show him the tape, and the guys in New York are going to go, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf there? Oh, that poor son of a bitch. I get off work that day, and I call my sponsor. I said, oh, we're really getting the gift now. Oh, and the miracle's a little bigger. He said, I guess God had enough writers and he needed a few cooks today. Then he said, you know, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. As long as he's having a good time. One of the men that I sponsored got sick and was dying, and I got to be there for him during his death, and my father came back into my life, and I felt his presence again. I was able to talk to him, and I was able to tell his grandsons about him, because my sons had no relationship with my father, because I couldn't talk about him. And I have gotten to do that with more than that man since then. About 5 months ago, one of the guys I sponsored was getting ready to make the transition, and we were in a hospital room with this guy. And I couldn't show up for my father the night he died. And my sweet Jim P., I held him, and we took the first 3 steps together, the 7th step together, the 11th step together. I looked at this man, I looked into his eyes, and I said, do you know you've done good work here? And he said, yes, I do. He turned to a guy by the side of the bed, and he said, I'm okay, I'm sober, and he died. How can such a thing? How could you guys put me in that room? You put me in that room. You know. And so if you're new here, I don't know what you're coming in with. I don't know who you didn't show up for. I don't know whose life you destroyed. I don't know if you strangled a puppy, you know. I'll tell you one thing. If you strangled a puppy, we got a guy here who has strangled 2 puppies. You know, we can play Can You Bottom This? I mean, I guarantee it. We got a guy somewhere who can bottom you. But that's not our point. You see, I used to sponsor a man who did what I could have done 1,000 times. He had a couple of beers, got in his car, ran over a 9-year-old boy and killed him. I could have done it 1,000,000 times. 1,000,000 times. And he couldn't get it. He could not get the fact that if he got here and stayed sober, he could look into the eyes of someone who has taken a life and say to them, this is for you too. I love you. I love you, and this is for you too. And I don't kill children anymore. Now, I'm not saying I can't help that guy, but not like him. I can't help him like him. And our sons today are remarkable young men. They're both communists. I can't torture my in-laws anymore because it's part of my program. I just send my kids in to talk to them. That's it. Go talk to Grandpa. Where the boys wound up, a little while ago, Jesse had broken his wrist, and was in a growth plane, and if you know anything about little kids, when they get hurt in a growth plane, once you get set, you can't get disturbed because it's a growth plane, you know?
And Mike and he were doing something physical and they were messing around and it was too rough and I had to go talk to Mike and I had to chew him out because it was unacceptable. This is not like something I could come in later and catch him doing again because it was serious stuff. And I got right up in his face and I yelled at him. He walked away from me, went in his room and he slammed the door. Slammed the door. So I got the dad tick now, you know. So I go to have a little additional conversation with him, you know, and I open the door, and before I got it going, he looked at me and said, hold it. I didn't tell you you were wrong out there. You were right. But a big guy just got up in my face and screamed at me. I'm not telling you you're wrong. Don't tell me I can't be mad. Confusing as my sponsor, you know? My wife and I had to stop working on our relationship. My idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until you change your mind. That's my idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until your eyes roll back in your head and you keel over and on the way down you go, oh, okay. It's a war of attrition. Surround the castle and starve them out. Just keep talking. We had to work on ourselves and try to bring a better person to the deal. That's what we had to do. And my whole life I never felt like a grown man. Grown men show up for their father the night they're dying. I hadn't felt like a grown man ever. And I've stood next to men 10 years younger than me my whole life and I say, I wonder what it feels like to be grown up. That's a crappy way to live, man. You're never in your life. You're always almost having a life. And once I started doing the work in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out why. I didn't know why. 18 years of psychotherapy didn't help me. Having a wife, having kids, they didn't make me feel like a grown man. Nothing ever did, except for Alcoholics Anonymous. And once I started seeing the reasons why, it was pretty remarkable. We have a sexual inventory in our book described on page 69 and 70. And I take that sexual inventory not only as for my ideal sex life, but for my ideal life, the way I want to be in my marriage. It says an incredible thing. It says after we write about where we've been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, unjustifiably aroused, jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness, it then tells us to write what we should have done instead. It says we write about our ideal. We ask God to help mold us and walk toward this ideal. It basically tells me I can take a look where I'm wrong, I can decide the kind of man I want to be, and then in partnership with God, I can walk toward that. Not in partnership with me. That's one drunk talking to himself. No big kick there. That's the Scott Redmond program. Not in partnership with a wife, with a therapist. That's a straight line. In partnership with God, I can walk toward this. And that's exactly what's happened to me. I have been able to walk toward that and begin, in some ways, have become the man I always wanted to be and am still walking. And once I took a look at those 7 points within the confines of my marriage, some incredible stuff started happening. Where have I been selfish? I want what I want when I want. Where had I been dishonest? When I really took a look at that, it shook me up. A grown man should live in a clean house. I mean, that's something I've seen grown men do. Make a bed or clean up, not live like a pig. And but I'm not cleaning the house to live in a clean house. I'm cleaning the house because I think somewhere in the back of my twisted noodle that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. Right? That there should be conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. A couple of poor men in here going, yeah, oh, yeah. Where do you get that? Get that... Very drum of that stuff. I had to start cleaning the house to clean the house. Not clean the house to go, I'm finished, honey. Something that always thrilled her, you know. No, I don't like to clean the house, and I don't know how. So I do it for God. Boy, wish you told me that my first day. Stick around here and you'll clean the house for God. Ah! It's a miracle. Oh, my God. I started feeling like a grown man. Then my sons and I started cleaning, having an hour on the weekend where we clean together. Some of the best times I've ever had with my kids. We put on loud rock and roll music, blast it from one end of the house to the other, and criticize each other's cleaning. Nancy and I have just celebrated 20 years of marriage, and the boys are, I'm having a great time with them. And it's not because God likes us better than the people who are getting divorced. That's just what's happening in my house. We live in Sherman Oaks, and we just got whacked, creamed in the big earthquake. You know, just nailed. Nancy claims that I left a footprint on her forehead getting out of bed. I think she's lying. And we really got shook up real bad. And shortly after the earthquake, we were at an AA function, and a woman at the AA function out of town said to me, "Oh, I'm so glad God got us out of L.A. before the quake." I said, "Oh, so he likes you, but we're crap." And she said to me, "No, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn." Oh, bartender. Hello? Hello? I'm out of here. If I got a God up there saying, "No evacuation plan for you, young man," I'm out of here. Get the Redmond boy. Get him. Till his goat, put a finger in his eye, turn his wife to salt. Get the Redmond boy. I'm out of here. Now, I know that God's keeping her sober, and I know he wouldn't keep me sober for 3 seconds. If I got a God up there dealing out punishment, picking people to save and people to put in the crapper, I'm out of here. So that's just what's happening in our house. That's what's happening in our house. We celebrate 20 years of marriage. Other people are getting divorced. My God expects me to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous no matter what happens in my house. He expects me to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous if Nancy and I stay together or not. So I don't say, for me, I don't say, it's God's will that my wife and I be married. My God's will is real simple, and I never have to question it. My God's will for me is that I be as free, as undriven as possible by sexual misconduct, resentments, and fears, so I can draw close to him and he'll reveal himself to me. So that I can take a tower of human sewage who couldn't even stay sober the night his dad died, who couldn't even be kind to his kid and make him of some use in this world. That's my God's will. When I come, what job should I take? It's not a spiritual test for me. I'll go crazy if I do that. My God expects me to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous if it's my job is to show a man how I made a boneheaded decision about what job to take. Now, the more it's one drunk talking to himself, the more shot I have at a boneheaded decision. That's why I have a sponsor who I love and respect. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to AA. I want to suggest to you that you're in a very dangerous situation. And that some really extraordinary stuff could happen to you. A story I haven't heard really, a guy who used to be in my home group who's passed away now, named Bill, used to tell my favorite story about a newcomer doing 12-step work, and I want to share it with you today. He tells a story about an old-timer grabbing this newcomer and getting the 12-step call, and they get in the car. Newcomer's been around a couple of months, and they drive down this road, and they get out to a dirt road, and they get down the dirt road, and they get to a lean-to. It doesn't even have a door. It's just got like a burlap flap, you know. They walk in, and there's this drunk sitting on a stained mattress in a pair of old underwear with just, and all there is a mattress and a little candle flickering in a can, and the guy's sucking on a bottle of wine, and the newcomer looks at him and says, "Look, I don't know much about this deal. I'm new. But I'll tell you one thing for sure that I know. If you keep drinking, you're going to lose all this." So if you're new, I'd like to suggest to you you're in a dangerous situation. You're about to lose the candle in the can, and we want you to stay. We want you to stay. Sometimes a newcomer will say to me, "Geez, drinking is the furthest thing from my mind." To which I usually reply, "No, your mind is the furthest thing from your mind." Now, I want to tell you why I'm so doggone unimpressed with the proximity of drink to your mind. And I'm not knocking you, and I'm not criticizing you. I'm just telling you that my understanding of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is that virtually the entire book is engineered to try to drive home one point. That if you really have alcoholism, and drinking is the furthest thing from your mind, you put whiskey in your milk. Boom, you're drunk. It doesn't say drinking was the furthest thing from my mind. Then I saw it coming, a little tiny drink on the horizon. I started thinking about it a little bit, started talking about it a little bit. It was a little bigger the next day, incoming. It doesn't say that. It says, boom, you're drunk. If you're in the clutches of this thing, if you haven't gotten out of the cycle of spree and remorse and into the cycle of surrender and commitment, you are a rabbit in an open field with very short grass, and the choppers are coming, you know? And that's why we say don't drink no matter what. If you're new here, you can make a deal with a God that you might understand, might not understand, or don't even want to understand. You can make it right here at this meeting with us today. You can make a deal with God and say, Father, I will accept the craving. Please remove the obsession. Every craving has a beginning, a middle, and an end. You can feel it break over you like a wave if you stop treating it with a drink. Every time a craving came up, I treated it with a drink or itself. If you stand and take the whooping, and it'll end. The obsession doesn't. But we can't help you with your obsession until you stop being driven by your craving. That's why we say call one of us. That's why we say go to a meeting. That's why we say keep coming back no matter what. Crawl on your belly. Do anything you can. Just don't drink. It's the weirdest thing anybody ever told me in my life. If you want to drink, don't. It's the weirdest thing anybody ever told me in my life. And I want to tell you, if you're new here, you might go to an AA meeting and not even hear a passing reference to the steps of Big Book, or God. And I get really confused. You might go to a meeting and just hear about issues and boundaries. And there's nothing wrong with that. But you see, in order to have an issue or a boundary, you have to not drink. If you don't drink, you will wind up with both an issue and a boundary. But you have to not drink. The not drinking part is a moose. If it wasn't for the not drinking part, we would be a much bigger organization. There's no question about it. If you are new here and you're wondering when you're going to get in touch with your feelings, stay sober, they'll get in touch with you. If you're new here, I want to suggest that you make that deal. This is the best deal in town. I can't tell you what an honor it is to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be allowed into your lives. And I didn't allow you into my life. You came and you got me, and you got my kids and my wife too, and for that I will forever be grateful. Thank you so much.